Forum took 5 years to write because it was a very difficult assignment that we'd given ourselves. When I say we, I mean Bert Chevalloff, who co-wrote the book, and Stephen Sondheim, who wrote for the first time words and music for a score. It took a long time because we really gave ourselves a kind of a numbing challenge to present what was essentially kind of a burlesque slash vaudeville show in the guise of a Broadway book musical comedy. Part of the reason we had trouble getting it on was because we were too good at it. We wrote very complete scripts. We wrote 10 drafts. Many of the directors who considered doing the show were full of ideas about how to change it. We didn't want to change it. We wanted it to be what we wanted it to be. And eventually, happily, and after 5 years, we found a director who wanted to do our show, serve our piece. That was George Abbott, who was a mere 75 at the time. He went on, of course, to continue in the theater well into his 100th, and well, he died at 106, I think he was doing the show at 104. So it took a long time because we had to find rather egoless people to work with. That's not an easy thing to find in the theater. Usually the ushers are the ones without ego.
Welcome back to Putting It Together, the podcast that goes through the entire body of work of Stephen Sondheim, show by show and song by song. My name is Kyle. I am the self-described expert on everything Sondheim, and we have reached the end. This is the end of A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, a twisty, turny season, which made me, I think, appreciate the show much more than I did when we first started. By the way, this episode is so late, and I apologize. It is currently 3:15 p.m. as I'm recording this, on the day it's supposed to be released, so you can see how fast I can work, I guess, when you see this drop into your podcast feed. In the intro, you heard from Larry Gelbart, co-writer of A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. The other writer was Bert Chevalloff, who, to be honest, I can find very little information about. His Wikipedia article is brief, and there's really no YouTube videos that I can find. He seems to be a bit of a footnote to the whole operation, other than getting respect from his co-creators on Forum. However, his name will reappear when we get to Company because of a show that he wrote, No No Nanette, winning some big Tony Awards against that masterpiece. All we really know is that he, along with Larry Gelbart, spent about 5 years writing and rewriting Forum to get it to the point where they were happy with the script. The decision to make it a musical seems to have been a bit of an afterthought, as I found out their instructions to Sondheim were to write songs that worked, but could be removed altogether if need be. Gelbart, if you're a fan of the American sitcom, is responsible for creating the TV show MASH, I would argue the most popular sitcom until Seinfeld years later. He also was the showrunner for the first 5 seasons. Now, this is not a MASH retrospective as much as I would love to talk about that for a long, long time, but you can see a similar comedic style in Forum as in those first few years of MASH. And I think that MASH actually has more of a political point of view than Forum even ever attempts, but the humor and worldview are very similar. But to stick mostly with theater, Gelbart continued his career after Forum with the musical City of Angels, which won him another Tony Award for Best Book of a Musical. Other works include Mastergate, Sly Fox, and this musical called Hail the Conquering Hero, which I love because this was a production that was an incredibly bad experience for everyone involved, it seems, because it stayed in this developmental hell before premiering. And it caused him to say the following thing. This is a direct quote from Larry Gelbart. He said, "If Hitler is alive, I hope he's out of town with a musical." So, you can see how much he had a good time. You'll hear later in this episode how successful Forum was, but not really for Stephen Sondheim. And when you consider everything but the music being praised in Forum, and then following it up with 2 epic flops, we're entering this bleak period of Sondheim's career. However, before we get too far, let me tell you that Putting It Together is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB. They promote and support Alberta-made podcasts and connect their audiences with Alberta-based businesses and organizations. The Alberta Podcast Network is also a sponsor this week, so I'd like to highlight a specific show for you. This week, I want to talk to you about a show that I've mentioned quite a few times. It's That's a Thing. This is a sometimes belated, already outdated guide to your teens, tweens, and everything under 20. Elizabeth teensplains her media to her mom, Karen, and Karen, of course, has been a guest on this show a few times, and I'm also working on a way to get them both on for next season, but this is such a great podcast, and one that increasingly makes me realize that I am no longer the target of most popular culture. Don't you want to share in my existential dread? As always, you can find That's a Thing in all the great shows by going to albertapodcastnetwork.com. This episode is also brought to you in part by the Alberta Blue Cross Wellness Summit, which happens on October 10th. The Wellness Summit is a day to explore fresh perspectives and practices around wellness. This year, the focus is on what it takes to create healthy workplace cultures where everyone thrives. Supporting the health and wellness of employees is becoming a major consideration for many workplaces, and Alberta Blue Cross wants to connect the dots of what it takes to create healthier workplaces with happy people. Among the speakers this year is Mandy Trapp, founder and lead educator of Lifestyle Meditation. Mandy has been an active part of Edmonton's health and wellness scene for the past 20 years. Her mission is to blend the science and wisdom of meditation and mindfulness to educate others and build resilience. Alberta Blue Cross has designed the summit so that you're not just sitting and listening. You'll have a chance to actively engage with the information, the speakers, and other attendees, and will come away with practical tools and evidence-based resources you can use whether you're a frontline worker or a C-suite executive. Connection happens here. The summit is at the Renaissance Edmonton Airport Hotel on October 10th. Learn more at thewellnesssummit.ca. That's thewellnesssummit.ca. All right, and now it's time for Plodding Along. This is where I describe what's currently happening in the plot. Miles is distraught because of his supposedly dead bride. He decides to burn her as an offering back to the gods. However, Hysterium, dressed as Philia, jumps up before this can happen and runs off. This is all detailed in the first song we'll hear, called The Funeral Sequence. At this point in the show, the farce has built up to its peak. An epic chase ensues, with all the characters running into each other in increasingly funnier situations. It then culminates in Miles figuring everything out, but then Aronius returns and figures out that Miles and Philia are actually brother and sister, and he's their dad. We then get a resolution that benefits all the characters. Soothless gets his freedom, Hero and Philia get each other, Miles gets the twins, and, well, the finale will answer what everyone else gets. Thanks to all our sponsors. Take a look at the show notes for information about the music we're referencing and how to get your own book of Sondheim lyrics. Let's now listen to a section from the original Broadway cast recording of the funeral sequence and the finale. Afterwards is my conversation with the always great Federico Tedeschi.
Divided, get coincided, something for everyone.
A comedy tonight.
Father and mother, get one another.
Something for everyone.
A tragedy tonight.
I get the twin.
Federico Tedeschi, thank you so much for coming back.
Thank you again for having me.
I thought it would be appropriate, seeing as that you started this whole entire forum season, for you to actually end it as well. So it's a nice little circle that we've made here today.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite shows, and I couldn't be happier.
Just in case, we do this at the beginning of everything, but maybe just a brief overview of who you are and what it is that you do. I think there's been new things since the last time you were on.
Well, that would be very optimistic of you, but basically, I was a student until a couple of months ago, because I graduated in classics, and I've been a fan of Sondheim ever since I was 14, and I fell in love with Sweeney Todd, and ever since I studied and reviewed all the work of Stephen Sondheim, and I think he's the greatest composer ever of musical theater.
I think that's more than enough to have you on the show, that's for sure. How has been, post-education life so far?
It's been weird because, you know, I have basically been studying for 20 years nonstop.
Right.
And after you graduate, you are like in this limbo where you don't know what to do. And you have all your, you know, dreams and hopes in front of you, and you don't know which road to follow. And it's been a blast because I'm having a lot of fun with my friends. But in the meantime, it's been a bit cloudy. Let's say this.
So let's say that you got like everything that you want, or like the dreams that you have. Like, what would be the next step in your life?
Oh, well, a better question would be, what is my big dream? Because, you know, right
okay,
now,
sure.
Again, there is that confusion going on. And I think finding the answer to that is a good starting point.
I think, too, that, I mean, having been in the same situation as you are, I find that our lives kind of go in these really interesting directions.
Yeah.
There's, even if you do have it like all figured out, quote unquote, like it's like, this is what I'm going to do, and then it's going to happen.
Yeah,
after again, this.
There's that Sondheim song called Merrily We Roll Along.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Bending with the road.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's like sometimes there'll be things offered to you, or yeah, exactly. Opportunities that you had never even dreamed of.
Yeah.
Or things like this, where podcasting wasn't even a thing when I was growing up. So there would be no way for me to think, I want to do a podcast when I grow up. It didn't exist at that point.
It just happened,
so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, today we're talking basically about the ending of A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. So everything has kind of led to where we're at right now. I find that something that has been kind of talked about here in the past few episodes, but just to put a fine point on it, the first half of the show, or at least act one, I think is very pseudolist heavy, where we understand like him, he's basically our main character. We know what his goal is, his dream, if he wants to become free. And then the second act of the show, I think, is given over a little bit to some of the supporting characters. So you get like a song by Domina, you get a song by Philia, you get a song by Hysterium. So there's all these other characters that are being added to the show here at this point.
I think also that the second act, as always, because it's a trend in shows, is a little bit less concerned with music, with songs. Mm.
I agree with that, because all the songs that are in the second act are like super short. Like it's like,
yeah, short,
2 minutes or less.
And they are very narrative songs. They aren't like, Free, for example. Free is not a narrative song. It's more like a want song. Whereas we have the funeral sequence here, which is a very weird song, but it's very narrative. It drives forward the plot. And I think that's, it's a very interesting point for this show, because as you've said millions of times, I guess, songs were not supposed to be in this show. And so Sondheim tried to find a compromise between the two things, you know, not having songs in the show, but having songs in the show.
Yeah, it's a really hard thing to do, which I think actually Sondheim does a really good job of.
Yeah, exactly.
Which was his actual task was write songs, but songs that we could take out if we needed to.
Yeah, I think that the only song that really stands out and really, really makes a point is Comedy Tonight at the beginning and Comedy Tonight at the end.
Right, because you're setting up what you're about to see, and then it's like that punctuation mark
exactly.
At the very
end
of the show.
You're going to have fun. Here's why, because we have all these, tools and for comedy. You get the comedy, and then at the end of the show, you're like, the cast are like, I told you, you were going to get comedy. Have a good night and leave the theater.
Yeah. No, get out. Yeah,
get out. Like the producers.
Yeah, right. I think it works. I mean, again, this is me harping on this some of the same points here, but I think that the movie does show though that there are some songs that add to the flavor here a little bit. Where if it's only the farce that you get to see, while there can absolutely be really funny bits, I think that the music is able to, let us sit in some of the comedy a little bit more. And, some of the music is just really good to listen to. So I enjoy most of the, or a lot of the songs that are in this
show.
Yeah,
it's that classic Broadway feel and mood, you know. that like Hollywood-themed music. I don't know if that's even a thing, but that's that 60s music feel to the score, which is just gorgeous.
Yeah. So we're going to go through the last two songs, which again are pretty short for both of them. The funeral sequence and then the reprise of Comedy Tonight. And then we're going to play a game, which I told you about. So hopefully you haven't cheated, but we'll see.
I have.
So the first song here is the funeral sequence. And here we have Hysterium laying on this like little platform, pretending to be Philia, who they're pretending to be dead. All these plot contrivances that have gone on here throughout the show. And of course, what Miles wants to do is to kind of like set the whole thing on fire, to like burn the virgin, send her back up to the gods, that sort of idea. Just because I like to give credit as much as I can, this song is primarily going to be sung by Miles and Pseudolus. So Pseudolus, as we know, was portrayed by Zero Mostel in both the original Broadway cast and in the film version, Nathan Lane in the 1996 revival. And then Miles in the original Broadway cast was played by Ronald Holgate, in the film by Leon Green, and in the 1996 revival by Chris Groendahl, which I'm pretty sure I'm butchering his last name, but that's all right. And as you said, this is a kind of a weird song. It is very much, I find, actually, I think it's even in the movie version, they don't call this the funeral sequence, they call it the dirge, is what they call it in the track listing, which I think is actually kind of appropriate because it sounds like a dirge, which is...
What's a dirge?
I think the official is just like a mournful song is okay. Is what a dirge is supposed to be.
Okay. Yeah, it's appropriate. You know, it's a word I've never heard. So I'm sorry about that question.
Oh, no. It's... Let me just do this. Let me give you like the actual dictionary definition here. So a dirge is a lament for the dead, especially when forming part of a funeral rite.
Okay.
It's a sad song. Miles starts off by saying, "Sound the flute, blow the horn, pluck the lute, forward mourn. All Crete was at her feet, all Thrace was in her thrall, all Sparta loved her sweetness and gall." And then Pseudolus says, "And Spain..." While the mourners all say, "All Crete was at her feet, all Thrace was in her thrall," as they're kind of like repeating what Miles just said.
Sound the flute, blow the horn, pluck the lute, forward mourn.
Spain
and Greece
and Egypt
and Syria
and Mesopotamia.
So definitely we're going through some internal rhymes and stuff that are going here, like Crete and feet, Thrace and thrall, Sparta and Gaul. Like they're trying to use some of these different places and stuff like that.
There's a question I want to ask you. What do you think about this song?
I mean, I really don't love it.
Okay.
And anytime this comes up on my, like, if I shuffle some of my songs, like this is the one I always skip because it's like, I don't really want to listen to it. I will say, having kind of forced myself to re-listen to it, that there is like this one piece in the Broadway revival, the 1996 version, that I think is really funny, but it's like
which
literally
comes later,
15 seconds of like a 2.5 minute song.
I think that the charm of this song is the music itself, and it's.
I agree with that. I think the music is actually fairly pretty. It's just like the lyrics and the singing I have no use for.
Yeah, it's just it's basically puns, and there's this anecdote by Sondheim himself about the song "Can That Boy Foxtrot" from Follies.
Right,
and
right.
He says he wrote this song with the pun. That this boy is completely inept. He can't do anything. But boy, can that boy foxtrot? And that was the joke, the pun. And he said, okay, it lands once. It lands twice. By the third time the joke lands, everybody was like, okay, we got it. And this song is basically like this.
I agree, because really, like, I think that the basic need for this song is that you do have Hysterium on this, you know, this little platform in the center of the stage. Mm-hmm. They're going to set a fire to it. And we know, as the audience, that that person is still alive. Sudeless knows that that person is actually alive. No one else does.
Yeah.
Everyone else has been roped into this thing of like, oh, that's Philia, this beauty. She's dead, so we need to burn her. So it's like, once we get to that point, it's like, okay, yeah, we get what is funny about this, what is ironic about this scene. We just need to get to the point where Hysterium wakes up and runs away.
Just cut it out. I think that every line of this song builds up to that moment that you talked about, which comes later in the song, which I'm not going to talk about right now because we don't want to spoil anything. But yeah, the overall thing, the overall lyrics of this song is basically puns, except for one line, which I think is quite clever, because I think Sondheim is a geek, is a nerd, and there's that.
Which line is that?
Forward morn.
Okay.
I don't know if it was intentional, but back in the days, and by back in the days I mean in ancient Rome, during funerals, the parents of the dead actually paid people to go to funerals to cry.
No way.
Yeah. And I don't know if Sondheim did it on purpose, but that forward mourn, I think it's about that. Because we have Milis saying to the people mourning to mourn, to cry, and then the crying starts.
And well, I think that's really smart. I bet you're right in some way. Yeah, yeah.
I don't think that all those people crying at the funeral actually cared about the fake Philia. So I think they were paid, but right. That's like a headcanon in my head.
I like that reading of it, though, because I think that taking into account of that history, I mean, Miles too is like this big brutish man. So, I mean, I'm sure he's forcing some of his men to care when they don't really care.
Yeah, exactly. And it's perfectly in line with the character and with the history of, you know, rituals back in Rome. Forward mourn. Yeah, it's like, it's not something you say to people at funerals, you know, forward mourn.
And it's very much like a military command too, yeah, right? Unless like you pay forward, like march.
Unless you pay them to do it. Forward, mourn. It's I don't know if Sondheim did it on purpose. Kudos to him.
So it goes on here, and we basically just list off a bunch of different places. And as far as I understand it, maybe I'm misreading this from having watched the movie and listening to it. It sounds like Sudeless is trying to buy time. So he's just like listing off a bunch of other places for them to consider. So Mealy says, and Greece, and the mourners go, oh, why should such a blossom fall? Sudeless goes, and Egypt. Mealy says, and Syria. Sudeless goes, and Mesopotamia. And then Mealy says, speak the spells, chant the charms, toll the bells. And then Sudeless says, fold the arms to Hysterium. So he's telling Hysterium to fold his arms together.
And Spain, and Greece, and Egypt, and Syria, and Mesopotamia.
Oh, why should such a blessing fall?
The charms, toll the bells,
fold the arms, sir.
We're trying to. He's trying to stretch this out as far as he can.
Yeah.
Still trying to convince Hysterium to play dead because he doesn't want to be found out, but frantically trying to find a way to not have this person burn alive.
Yeah, basically, and everything has built up to that. Fold the arms. Basically, that's the high point of the song.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Which is the funniest part of the song, basically. You know, it's everyone is crying. It's a funeral, but that's the funny part of the song.
Yeah, and it also does that thing that I always love. This is not necessarily a Sondheim thing. This is much more a Broadway thing that happens in a lot of different shows. But I love it when a character finishes a rhyme that another character started.
Oh yeah.
It always is so great for me if it all works in concert with one another.
Yeah,
because Mealy says chant the charms, but it's Sudeless who says fold the arms, so that it all kind of rhymes together.
Yeah, it's very rewarding for everyone, for the characters, for the people in the audience, and for the songwriter.
The part that I was going to say about the revival, so like right after this, Miles says, strew the soil, strum the lyre, spread the oil, build the pyre. Okay. So two things out of that. First, before I get into my part that I like, is that a mispronunciation of lyre? Because I always thought it was lyre is how you said that word.
No, I think it's actually lyre because I think it has to do with the actual pronunciation in Greek, which is lyre.
Gotcha.
And,
gotcha.
You know, you English speakers tend to do this with the Y's that come from Greek.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Wherever there's a Y in a Greek word, it tends to be pronounced I. So I think
this is probably just because I'm a pretentious person too, because I read a lot of like fantasy and like myths and stuff growing up, and for some reason I always in my head pronounced it Lear, so that's how I've always pronounced it. So I think maybe it's just me that is wrong.
That's why.
Anyways, in the 1996 revival, what happens after this, which I think is actually just part of the script, there's an interchange between Miles and Sulis that goes back and forth, which is like, Sulis has like, what kind of pyre? And Miles says, the one with fire. And then Sulis goes back, oh, it's a fire pyre.
A pyre? What kind of pyre?
A pyre of fire.
Oh, a fire pyre.
She must be burned.
Burned, sir?
I want her ashes.
Captain, I implore you. It is not for us to destroy such loveliness. The gods are awaiting her. They would not be happy if we sent up a charred virgin.
I cannot afford to offend the gods.
I don't know why. I think it's very lovely and funny. Yeah, but it's just rhymes.
Stupid. It's fine. It's so funny. A fire pyre.
What's a fire pyre?
I don't know.
Because every pyre is a fire, as far as I understand it, anyways.
But. And again, it adds up to that Sulis buying time theme of the song.
Right.
I don't know if that's that joke, you know, the fire pyre, is actually in the original one.
I have a feeling that it probably was. They just didn't record it, is what my suspicion is.
Okay, because there's a libretto going around that could actually be referenced to, but I don't have it right now. That could be fun, you know, because I think it's a very Nathan Lane joke.
No, you're right.
You,
you're right.
You know 100%. My love for Nathan Lane, and that's like me being a fan. But I think that's
I love Nathan Lane too. Yeah,
it's a very Nathan Lane appropriate joke.
So then we do the ending. This is like the very dramatic, like the music is building up. It gets to this really high point where Miles, whoever plays him, is normally cast from like opera. It's an opera singer who normally is cast in this role. So he finishes off saying, "All Crete was at her feet, but I shall weep no more. I'll find my consolation as before among the simple pleasures of war." Which is, I think, says a lot about the Miles character.
Yeah, it's a weird ending.
Because what is he trying to say there? Which is like, I'm finding pleasure in burning this person. Like, that's basically what he's saying. Is like, I'm sad, but this person is dead. But I'm also finding pleasure because during wartime, I get to like kill people. Is basically what he's saying.
I don't know if I'm reading too much into it, but you know, in ancient times. Usually you didn't burn people at funerals. That's something that was reserved to soldiers and heroes in the myths.
Oh, gotcha. So what were the funeral rites in ancient Rome like then? It wasn't burial, was it?
Yeah, exactly. A basic burial.
Okay.
You know, we find tombs constantly, especially here in Rome, because I live in Rome. And anytime you have to do something like, build a train station for the underground, you find something in the soil and you have to stop the work because you find a tomb or you find an ancient villa or something like that. And Rome is like plastered with ancient tombs. And that's, yeah, basically burials. You don't, yeah. They didn't burn, let's say, prostitutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, they didn't burn courtesans. That's a better word. But I think that's because he's used to do it, because that's what soldiers did, actually.
That's I find that just such a an odd thing to become used to, right? It's like, okay, we're going to put in this new train line, and oh my gosh, more bones?
Exactly.
All right, stop, everyone.
It happens all the time. All the time.
There was actually a story here a few years ago about in England where they were going to actually, it was a parking lot. That's all they were going to build, was a parking lot. And they actually weirdly discovered Richard III's bones in this place where they're going to build a parking lot.
Yeah, and we find even ancient, even more ancient.
Yeah.
We find bones.
More ancient, yeah.
Yeah,
yes.
Even more ancient. And it happens all the time. If you ever come to Rome, mm-hmm. you can see many, many of these, like building sites. Yeah. You find many building sites over the city, all over the city, because they started building something, but then had to stop because, you know, archaeologists have to come and analyze. And it's good for us because I love this kind of stuff, but bad for the business.
Right. I will only come to Rome if you can promise I can ride a Vespa with a scarf around my neck.
Oh, that's so cliche.
I know it is. I have to be on that Roman holiday.
Yeah.
I get to be Audrey Hepburn.
You want
to
be Audrey Hepburn. Okay.
That's right. You would think I'd say Cary Grant, but no, I want to be Audrey Hepburn.
Everybody wants to be Audrey Hepburn.
Yeah.
And sing My Fair Lady all over the city, even though it's set in London.
I was going to say, even though it's not actually Audrey Hepburn singing in that show.
Yeah,
but
I prefer Julie Andrews. Well.
Yeah. Yeah, true enough. All right, well, we're not talking about My Fair Lady. We're talking about a funny thing. So I guess what is your overall impression about this song? I know you asked me about my overall liking, but what about you?
Okay, I think this is one of those early experiments that Sondheim did in order to develop his writing style. Because, you know, he always says that his greatest achievements for his career basically two songs, and they are Opening Doors and A Weekend in the Country. Opening Doors from Merrily and A Weekend in the Country from A Little Night Music. And he says he loves those songs because they are very narrative. They drive the plot from point A to point B. And I think this is one of those early experiments for his writing style. You know, we start the song without the pyre.
Mm-hmm.
We know that building a pyre would burn Stereo alive. And at the end of the song, he actually wants to build a pyre.
Right.
It's very basic narrative. But I think it's one of those, early experiments. I don't recall any other songs like this one before. Funny thing.
I think this is, you're right in saying this is definitely the most experimental Sondheim song that we've gotten to so far.
Yeah, I don't think that, you know, West Side Story had one or Gypsy had one, even because he didn't write the music for those two shows. This is the first one. This is the first Sondheim show with music and lyric by him. So he could play a bit with the tools he had, and he's a great songwriter because he likes to experiment a lot, and you know this will build up to Passion and even Merrily in the 80s where the plot is told backwards.
I think you can definitely see like elements of this even where you have like background vocalists and like there's two people singing and there's a lot of stuff going on. I'll reference actually Pacific Overtures. I think there's some parallels between this and some of the songs in Pacific Overtures. I just think it's better realized in Pacific Overtures than it is here.
I think that this show actually made him famous as the weird songwriter on Broadway.
Sure.
Yeah, because you were all, they were all used to, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein and people like them. But this is the new kid, the weird one, the one that writes a song about a funeral sequence in a very weird way. Mm-hmm. And it's actually good. In a very weird
not,
way.
Not to take us too far off track here, but so the Tony Awards were this past Sunday. As we're recording this year, at least. And there is that new revival of Oklahoma, of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Oklahoma, that looks phenomenal. They just have a really interesting cast that they've cast with. And the main character, or one of the main characters, is in a wheelchair for the entire thing. But she did such a phenomenal performance. And she actually won a Tony Award for her performance, too. Like, it was just so good.
I used to watch the Tonys every year. But this year, I haven't. And that makes me want to go and watch it again. To watch the ceremony. Because, you know, it's like holidays. It's like Christmas.
It is. I love watching it still because I am, introduced to shows that I never heard of or didn't know about. So it's always fun for that.
Who hosted them this year?
James Corden hosted again this year.
Oh, James Corden.
Yeah, who himself has won Tony Awards. He's a fine theater actor. He does a late show now in America, which is fine. Yeah. It's not great, but it's fine.
And he was in Into the Woods.
He was in Into the Woods, which in a different universe would have also been a good movie. But we'll get to that point.
With a good second act.
Yeah. Let's get to the finale here then. So this is essentially just a Comedy Tonight reprise. I'm going to go through the whole thing because it's not that long. And then we'll talk about some of the language and words that are used.
Mm-hmm.
So Sudla says, lovers divided get coincided, something for everyone. And Hero and Philia say, a comedy tonight. Sudla then goes, father and mother get one another. Domina says, something for everyone. And Senec says, a tragedy
lovers
tonight.
Lovers divided get coincided, something for everyone.
A comedy tonight.
Father and mother get one another.
Something for everyone.
A tragedy tonight.
I get the twins.
Miles goes, I get the twins, they get the best. Aronia says, I get a family. And then Hysterium says, I get a rest. Soldiers go, we get a few girls. Lycus goes, I'll get some new girls. And then Sula says, I get the thing I want to be, free. And then everyone joins in, free, 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 free.
I get the twins, they get the best.
I get a family,
I get a rest.
We get a few girls,
I'll get some new girls.
I get the thing I want to be, free, free.
And then all together they all sing, nothing for kings, nothing for crowns, something for lovers, liars, and clowns. What is the moral? Must be a moral. Here is the moral, wrong or right? And then Sula says, morals tomorrow. And then they all come together and say, comedy tonight. And that's how the show ends. That's the curtain. All right, so, I mean, it's the exact same rhyme scheme. It is Comedy Tonight, but just kind of updated here for the end of the show. Anything that immediately jumps out at you at all?
You still get jokes at the end of the show. That's
sure, sure.
Yeah, that's something that really points out to me. And some of the jokes are actually quite fun, because there's something for everyone, a tragedy tonight.
Yeah.
It's the funniest one.
It's the one that it's the part that makes all the audience laugh usually, and yeah. I think this sums up so much about the relationship between Domin and Senex. Senex obviously feels trapped in this marriage. We had a great conversation with Xena, the guest, for That Dirty Old Man, the one that Domina sings, where I think she's such a much more tragic character than what even the show thinks that she is, but that Sondheim, I think, believes her to be.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of too bad that it's like she wants more out of her life and that she's still stuck with this guy who doesn't want to be with her anymore.
Yeah, but that's a trope of comedy. So
yeah,
it's true. Okay to have it. I mean, in the 60s, yeah, it's especially in the 60s, it's okay to have such kind of trope of comedy.
Right.
Yeah, and Miles confirms himself as this, boastful character.
I get the twins,
they get the best. That's the last line of Miles, and it's perfectly appropriate. And poor Hysterio gets finally a rest.
I know. Being so frantic and anxious for like the last 40 minutes of this show. It's like, yeah. I just get to go and sleep now because I don't have to be freaking out about everything.
Yeah, it's the heartwarming joke. I get a rest.
I want to talk specifically about kind of like the very, very end here because everyone is like, and they kind of whisper this lyric a lot, which is like, what is the moral? Must be a moral. Here's the moral. Like they're about to actually say something and then Seuss like just cuts them off, right? It's like, no, we'll do morals tomorrow. It's a comedy tonight. We're going to leave them laughing. It doesn't matter what this show is about.
Yeah, I think that's appropriate because for the whole time, especially at the beginning of the show, you get the feeling that you're not going to see something that teaches you anything. You know, it's just comedy. This play, the whole play, is a farce.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you're not supposed to learn anything from farce. It's not actually a comedy in the sense that you get something, you learn something by laughing about it. It's just farce. It's slapstick comedy, and it's great because of this. You know, it's a comedy that doesn't want to take itself seriously. And during the whole plot, it doesn't take itself seriously.
Mm-hmm. I mean, to delve into that a little bit more, I mean, I'm 100% in agreement with you. Like, farce is there to just be funny. And yeah. I don't necessarily think that this show is trying to have, like, a subversive point to it. At the same time, is there a moral that you could maybe create that the show is trying to say?
I don't even think that it could be a moral in this show. From this show. Because it's set so back in time, you know, mm-hmm. and it tells you about values we thankfully lost, like, for example, slavery. You know, the thing that Sudulus wants is to be free because he's a slave. What can you learn from that? Hopefully nothing, because we don't have slavery anymore, thank God.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the fact that it's set so back in time, it adds to the point that there's no moral in this. It's not immoral; it's amoral.
Yeah, that's a great way to phrase it. Yeah, yeah. I guess what I've kind of discovered is that while I don't think that the show or the book writers have anything necessarily that they're trying to say with this, like, it's like we're just trying to make jokes or we're trying to make this funny for audiences to laugh. That being said, what I do think is true is that it is very clear to me that Sondheim, in order to write effectively, needs to have the character very firmly in his head.
Yeah.
And I think you can see in some of his songs and some of his lyrics, even if it's very small subtext, he is creating backstories and wants and fears inside of these characters because he needs that in order to write effectively. And so it's almost fascinating to have gone through each of these songs individually because it's like, oh, if I didn't know about what the plot was and all I had was to focus on these lyrics, I could construct an entirely different show around these songs that you could use to have like a big point brought forth.
Yeah, and that's why the songs are so. That's why the songs seem so out of place.
Right, right.
Yeah, because
why they get cut out all the time?
Yeah, from shows. And that's why we have a second act so scarce of song because they are kind of out of place, because there are no morals, and Sondheim needs morals to write for the characters.
Mm-hmm.
But it's weird. Yeah, it's a weird show, and that's why he was the weird kid on Broadway back then.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, talking about the weird kid on Broadway, though, I mean, this was like an absolute hit when it debuted on Broadway. This was a huge hit for Sondheim and everyone involved. Sondheim writes about this because it was a very troubled production. We've talked a little bit about that on this show already, about the like tryouts that they went to and people just were not liking this show. And then he created Comedy Tonight and that turned it all around. And then they come to Broadway and it's like this really great artistic and financial success for everyone. So at the very end of the chapter on A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, Sondheim writes this, where he says, when we opened on Broadway, the bitter began to outweigh the sweet 2-1. The reception was ecstatic for everything but the songs. Shortly thereafter, Forum was nominated for some Tony Awards, and the only major category missing was best score. So as I sat home licking my wounds and watching everyone receive their silver discs and thank one another profusely on national television, I had nothing to console myself with but the knowledge that the show was a huge success and I would make some money. It was, in fact, the biggest hit in its Broadway run that I've ever been connected with. And success healed things between my collaborators and me, as success often does. Moreover, the collaboration turning sour under tryout pressure had one hidden benefit. It prepared me for my experience on the next show, which unfortunately didn't have the compensation of being a hit. It was a failure of the most flamboyant order and my first. So a little bit of a foreshadow to what the next show we're going to be talking about is.
You talk about that.
Yeah, but it's interesting, right, about how much this show is liked. And yet, no one seemed to like the music when it first came out. Like, everything else was nominated except for, like the comedy is great, the writing is great, the acting is great, but the songs, whatever, those don't matter so much. Everything else is what we want to honor here on Broadway's Biggest Night.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, it's so unreal to me because, you know, in my head, A Funny Thing is a classic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a classic. The whole thing is a classic. The book, the music, and the lyrics, the whole package is a classic. And to think that back then nobody liked the songs, it's just unreal to me.
It is weird. It is very weird.
Especially since later in his career, Sondheim is going to write two major flops. The only two real major flops of his career.
Yeah, I mean, it is, we're going into a very interesting period here, right? Because, so, just to kind of bridge everything we've talked about on this podcast so far, we start with him writing lyrics with Leonard Bernstein doing music in West Side Story, right? And mm-hmm. So that's a huge success, right? The movie was a huge success, but it was just a great learning experience. He was with everyone that was at the top of their game. Moves on, works with Julie Stein, this old starwort who had a bunch of songs. They were working with vaudeville, the stuff that he loves anyways. And he's able to help write lyrics for like one of the most quintessential of Broadway divas, which is Mama Rose. Then we come into Comedy Night. A bit of a weird one to start with your writing music and lyrics at the same time, especially when you know what comes afterwards. But again, huge success. So we've had basically three successes and then one huge success.
Yeah.
and then we're going to follow that up by two absolute complete flops.
Yeah, the Dark Ages.
The Dark Ages of Sondheim, which we then get resurrected, where we have like just the string of him being like both commercially and critically acclaimed, and him really coming into his like own voice when we get to Company, right?
So I think it's
amazing.
I think that's also the redemption of Sondheim, because A Funny Thing is, I would say, a weird show, and it was a success. Then he writes Anyone Can Whistle and Do I Hear a Waltz. I don't know if the order is correct, but those two are the shows, and they are classic Broadway shows. There's nothing experimental up except for a couple of songs, and they are two huge flops. Then he gets to write Company, which is the most experimental Sondheim, the most experimental show he had written. And that's the success. That's the huge hit.
And well, definitely because it's like a show that is like, we're saying this in the modern day, which,
yeah,
I mean, not that it had never happened before, but it's like talking about those types of topics, definitely not. Like, he was really pushing some boundaries when he decided to do that.
It was a novelty, and it was accepted and appreciated and awarded because of that. And that's, I think, very... that's the redemption of Stephen Sondheim.
Yes. So, okay, we're now gonna move on, and we're gonna play a game.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's gonna be guess how many awards it won, which I can't remember if that's actually what I named it the last time. But I'm gonna try and see if we can make a little music cue for that to use. But okay, so let's first start off with, it's 1963. We're at the Tony Awards for the original Broadway cast. Can you guess, first of all, how many awards it was nominated for that year?
I would say, totally random, 10.
Ooh, very close. It was nominated for 8 awards.
8, okay.
I'm going to make sure I did my math right. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yes, so it was nominated for 8 awards. Now here comes the follow-up. How many of those 8 did it win?
It didn't win best score, because you told me like a couple of minutes ago.
Well, it wasn't even nominated for it, so nominated. Yes.
Yeah. I would say out of this, like 7 out of the 8.
It won 6.
6, okay.
6 awards. Eight. And it actually is interesting. I don't think they're, well, in a weird situation, it could have won all 8, but it was never probably going to be able to win all 8. And I'll tell you why here in a moment. So here are the ones that it won. So it won Best Musical that year. It won Best Producer of a Musical, which I don't think is a category anymore, but that went to Hal Prince. Best Author, so that was Burt Chevalov and Larry Gelbart. Best Performance by a Leading Actor, that went to Zero Mostel. Here's the category that would have been hard for it to win, because for Best Performance by a Featured Actor in a Musical, there was 2 nominations from this show. So David Burns, who played Senex, and then Jack Gilford, who played Hysterium. It was David Burns who won. So the person who played Senex won. And then Best Direction of a Musical for George Abbott. So George Abbott won for Best Direction of a Musical.
Okay.
The only category it flat out did not win was Best Performance by a Featured Actress, which was Ruth Cobart, who played Domina. She lost. And she lost to a lady named Anna Quayle for a show called Stop the World, I Want to Get On, which I'm not familiar with. I don't know what that show is.
There's a reference to that show in The Producers.
The Producers.
Yeah. You know, it won a lot. It won a lot.
Yeah, it won a lot of awards. Like, it almost did a full sweep of the categories.
Who won for best score?
Oh, I should have looked that up. Okay, give me 2 seconds. Okay, so after having done some scouring of the internet here, the person who won best scoring that year was Oliver.
Oh, Oliver.
Yeah. Which would go on actually to win best film actually a few years later at the Academy Awards. It went on for some other stuff, but yeah, Oliver is what won.
Understandable, because it's a classic show.
Yeah, I mean, it's that feel good show. It, like, every community theater here in North America does it at least once every few years. So
you know,
if you need to go and see Oliver, you probably can.
There are kids on stage, so
okay. So we get to the movie version. I'm going to ask you this. How many Academy Awards do you think the movie was nominated for?
Was it nominated for any?
It was.
Oh, that's weird. I don't think it was nominated for Best Movie.
No, it was not.
Okay. Thank God.
Basically, none of the major, I'll say major categories, it was not nominated for.
Probably Zero Mostel was nominated for Best Actor.
He was not.
He was not, okay. I have no idea. Like,
so it was nominated for 1 award.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually won that award.
Best
so it went one for best score. But that so that's not Sondheim, though, is the issue here.
Okay.
So this is another category that I do not believe actually exists anymore. Actually, I know it doesn't exist. But it was the Academy Award for Best Music Scoring of Music Adaptation or Treatment. So that went to a man named Ken Thorne. Basically, all that means is he's the arranger. He took all the music that was recorded and then arranged it into the movie to make it all sound good. So I think that was probably moved into like best like sound design stuff. Like that's basically what that award is.
Isn't that something like at the Tonys, best orchestration?
Yes. Yeah. There's best orchestration.
Something like that, yeah.
Well, okay. So The Revival. The Revival in 1996, the one that stars Nathan Lane. How many nominations did it have?
I don't know, but I hope all of them. I know that Nathan Lane was nominated.
He was nominated, yes.
And he
so
won.
So it's an interesting year. It 1996, Nathan Lane was actually the host of the Tony Awards that year. It actually is one of my favorite Tony Award openings of all time as well. Because it's him, Bernadette Peters, and... oh my gosh, why am I blanking on her name? Liza Minnelli. All kind of do this interesting opening together. Anyway, so he was nominated. He was also hosting. It was nominated for 4 awards that year. Because it's a revival, it's not actually eligible for everything possibly that it could be nominated for. But how many do you think it won?
I think it won for Best Actor.
You're right on that one.
It won for Best Actor, Best Revival, if I'm not mistaken.
You are mistaken for Best Revival.
I don't know then.
Yeah, so here it is. It was nominated for 4, like I said. It won one of those.
Okay.
And that was Nathan Lane. So Nathan Lane won for Best Performance by a Leading Actor in a Musical.
Okay.
It was also... This was a weird year, first of all. Okay, you have to realize that. So 1996 was also the year of Rent. We have to remember that. So Rent was very big on Broadway at the time. So best, but however, the awards went to some random people in my estimation. But here we go. Best direction of a musical. It lost that, and it actually went to George C. Wolfe for the show Bring In Da Noise, Bring In Da Funk. So that's who won for best direction of a musical that year. Louis J. Stadlin, who played Senex, was nominated for Best Performance by a Featured Actor in a Musical. He lost to Wilson Germain Heredia, who played Angel in Rent.
Okay.
And then for Best Revival of a Musical, it lost to the revival of The King and I that starred Donna Murphy and Lou Diamond Phillips that year.
Sondheim.
The King and I, also one of those shows that gets revived like literally every 4 years, it seems, on Broadway.
And there's a great Family Guy episode about that. Right. I don't know if you watched it.
it's been a few years since I've dipped into Family Guy, but...
Stop it! Stop clapping right now! What's wrong with you? These people shouldn't be encouraged. They should be punished. That man has committed murder here this evening, and the victim's name is Theodore. This is the kind of mind-numbing schlock that's turning our society into a cultural wasteland. This isn't art. This isn't even entertainment. This blows.
What I love about it is that Seth MacFarlane is a big fan of Broadway, so there's sometimes little jokes that get thrown in there that I'm sure only like Broadway fans will really get. I've been having this conversation with people here, too, like... musicals on Broadway have actually never been more popular. Like, what was the... Actually, I think they even said on the Tony Awards that the last year was the single most attendance on Broadway for, like, something like 40 or 50 years or something like that. Like, it's been doing really well.
Well, there's Hamilton.
Well, yes, true enough. There is Hamilton.
That's the there. Book of Mormon.
But there's... Yeah, but there's people coming to New York to watch... at least those big ticket item shows. And yet I feel like for film, I don't know what I would even consider like the last like breakthrough musical. I would say maybe Chicago was the last one I would say that general audiences like really enjoyed and wanted to go and see. But I feel that there's a way that you could bring some of these really interesting shows to an audience. It might not be like a huge big budget, $150 million budgeted movie, But you can still make it work, I think.
Well, you know, there's this Cats movie
that's
coming out.
Yeah, yeah.
It's going to be so interesting to see Cats Judy Dench as a cat.
Yeah, singing. We'll see. We'll see if there's any Hamilton rub-off, but In the Heights movie is going to very soon.
They announced it today that Lin-Manuel Miranda is going to be in the cast.
Yes, yeah. So, playing like a little bit part. Oh, and then West Side Story, the new movie of West Side Story is coming out too. So, I guess. And there's actually rumors that there's a new Gypsy being made as well, starring Barbara Streisand. So we'll see how that, that ever happens.
Yeah, it's been years since they talked about it. That's that Wicked adaptation.
Yeah, they still say that. I'm one of those people who I'm never convinced until they actually start filming. Yeah. And that's been like rumored to have been happening for also years and years.
Yeah.
We'll see. I mean, I'm actually somewhat shocked that Book of Mormon has not been tried to be made into a movie yet.
You know, that's that issue with a little song called Asadiga Ibowai.
Well, sure. Yeah, you're going to get like an R rating right from that.
Yeah. So. For example, in Italy, you cannot say that.
Okay, I got you.
Yeah, it's very dangerous to go and say that. Even legal.
Well, that might be part of it. So they'd have to maybe change some of the lyrics to actually get it past censors and stuff like that. And I mean,
that sucks.
If they don't make a Hamilton film, I'd be also shocked. But it's going to be years until it stops being profitable on Broadway.
These are the dreams of Broadway fans.
That's right.
But I think that the last great musical at the at the movies was La La Land.
La La Land, yeah. I like La La Land. I had a few problems with it, but I like the music in it quite a bit.
Yeah, you know, it's a weird film. Again, it's that subverted expectations film kind of film.
Yeah.
But I think that it was great. I hated, for example, The Greatest Showman.
No, weirdly enough, I've never seen it because I people I trust told me that I wouldn't like it, so I didn't go and see it.
No, it's like they had these songs and built a film around it. It's
I could see that.
No, it's not good. I don't know why people like it. The cast
is fun.
The cast is great.
Yeah. That's actually my getting on my like film criticism hat here. I always feel so bad for Hugh Jackman because I think he's actually a really great actor who continually is in bad films.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, he's so weird as an actor. I mean, he's so charming. He's so gentle. And he's like so tall and so big.
Yeah, no, it's true.
And burly.
Okay, well, thank you so much for talking about burly men with me here today, Federico. Okay. I'm pretty sure I know the answer, but I ask it anyways. If people wanted to stay in contact with you, is there a way to do so?
Okay, that's basically my Instagram account, which you will link in the description, because spelling it is a little bit complicated. So if you want to hit me up, you can do it on Instagram.
All right, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, that's it. That's our season on A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. Thank you once again to Federico and all the guests this season. I will say we have one more special episode next week before I take a couple of weeks off to prepare the season on Anyone Can Whistle. Thanks to the Alberta Podcast Network, to ATB, and to the Alberta Blue Cross this week. Next time, we're going to be talking about films, adaptations, and possible recasting. If you have additional feedback, comments, questions, or a great guest idea, please send that to puttingittogetherpodcast@gmail.com. Also, a big thanks to the always great Chris Taniguchi, who designed the podcast artwork, and to Nick Driscoll for composing our theme music. For now, we've reached the end of our episode. Yes, I know. Goodbye for now. There's actually this really interesting, there was supposed to be another song called The Gaggle of Geese that Aronius was going to sing about figuring out that they were related and stuff like that. And just reading the lyrics, it's actually really funny, but they had to cut it for time.
Yeah, I have it on Finishing the Hat.
Yeah.
It's quite weird. The ring,
It is weird.
Bring the ring, yeah.
I'd like to know what the music sounds like.
Oh, but... yeah. Is there like a recording?
Of this one, I'm pretty sure there is not. Of some of the other cut songs, okay. There is.
Because, you know, there are those obscure recordings.
That's right.
That contain sometime the cut songs, like maybe reviews and this kind of show.
That would be a cool project to do. Do like a night. I mean, I don't know who would actually want to come, but it's like it would be like a night of Sondheim, but all the cut songs that never made it into the shows.
All the songs that people didn't like, but we have to.